This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. And this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Bernie Sanders was in the state last weekend, talking up his plans to address higher education costs. At UNH Durham, he greeted the crowd of more than 3,000.
You may not know this, but what you are part of tonight is the largest turnout for any presidential candidate in New Hampshire. Thank you.
Democrats gathered in Manchester last weekend for a state party convention. At the event, former U.S. Representative Carol Shea Porter announced her candidacy to regain her former 1st District seat and called for economic growth that will affect the rest of us.
We have to continue to grow the economy. We need more jobs, and we need wage fairness.
And at the State House, lawmakers are addressing a gap between upcoming federal and state ID requirements. Representative Sherman Packard of Londonderry filed a bill to give Granite Staters the option to apply for a real ID license, which would ease airport travel.
Instead of having to make, you know, a family of four go out and spend, you know, $600 on a passports, I mean, they can get a real ID compliant license. If they don't want to, they don't have to. It's not anything that's mandatory. It's completely voluntary.
Today on The Exchange, it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have three reporters joining me for the roundup this morning. Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Dean.
Kathleen Ronayne, State House reporter for the Associated Press. Kathleen, welcome back to The Exchange.
Good morning, Dean.
And Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader. Trent, it's good to have you back on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
There's so much to talk about this morning, but I want to start with a couple of stories that connect New Hampshire politics with politics in Washington. So let's begin with the latest on the controversy over federal funding for Planned Parenthood and talk about the involvement of our two U.S. senators, Jean Shaheen and Kelly Ayotte. Let's just start briefly, Kathleen, I'll turn to you, just briefly to remind listeners the New Hampshire context for the Planned Parenthood funding battle.
So the five-member executive council earlier this year chose to strip state funding for Planned Parenthood. They didn't approve a contract along party lines. So Chris Sununu...
We're having some technical difficulties. Josh, let me jump to you on this.
Well, earlier this year, the executive council voted to reject contracts with Planned Parenthood. Those contracts totaled about $650,000. The swing vote on that was Chris Sununu, who's, of course, running for governor now. He has been supportive of contracts with Planned Parenthood in the past, but said in light of videos shot by an anti-abortion group and edited in a somewhat tendentious way that raised questions about tissue donation and how Planned Parenthood was potentially harvesting organs of fetuses for sale. And tissue donation doesn't happen. Planned Parenthood of Northern New England isn't involved in that program. But in any case, this has obviously been a fraught political issue for some time. It was a controversial several years back when the Executive Council rejected some federal money and really politicized that body in a way that it normally hasn't been. And obviously nationally, we're talking about potential federal government shutdown over this issue, or at least that's being sought by some in the GOP.
Trent, we've been hearing about Jean Shaheen talk about this recently. She's been in the news on this.
Sure. So in the Senate, United States Senate, they're discussing whether or not to shut down the government over Planned Parenthood funding. Yesterday, they voted 47-52. Right after the Pope spoke to Congress, and Senator Shaheen says, "Look, I support Planned Parenthood. I think the federal government should fund it." Senator Ayotte says she doesn't support Planned Parenthood funding, but would not support shutting down the government over it. So it is a showdown that I think we're going to have to watch.
And Kathleen, we had some technical difficulties with your mic initially. Let's give it another try, see if you're up and running here on Planned Parenthood as well, and the Jean Shaheen and Kelly Ayotte, its involvement.
Yeah, I think this sets itself up along pretty typical partisan lines with Shaheen and Ayotte. I think that it's no surprise to anyone that Jean Shaheen would support Planned Parenthood and that Kelly Ayotte, I think she's been pretty clear in her position in the past. But it's interesting for Ayotte in terms of a political context. She's kind of trying to play both sides of the road here. You know, she's saying, I don't think we should be funding Planned Parenthood, but I also don't think that we should be shutting down the government over Planned Parenthood. And in a larger context, over the past week or so, we've seen Ayotte really try and focus on women's issues. We know that that's been a very effective line of attack for Democrats in New Hampshire to paint themselves as the party of women, Republicans as the anti-women party. And I think that what we're seeing is Senator Ayotte trying to thwart some of those attacks before they come at her. The New Hampshire Democratic Party has been criticizing her. But given that she doesn't have an opponent right now, she's kind of, I think, trying to steer the conversation a little bit more on her terms before someone gets in the race. So she's trying to set herself up as someone practical who's saying, you know, I don't think we should be shutting down the government, but at the same time, she's kind of walking this fine line of saying, I support women, I support women's health care, but I don't support Planned Parenthood. I think we're going to see this come up again and again throughout her campaign, whether Governor Hassan or someone else is challenging her.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about Senator Ayotte is she hasn't been afraid to hit some of the presidential candidates on this. Senator Ted Cruz, who spent a significant amount of time in New Hampshire, supports shutting down the government over Planned Parenthood funding. And Senator Ayotte sent him a letter saying, I don't think that you're right. And I think it's interesting to see her weigh in on the presidential level like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, she also went after Ted Cruz during the last government shutdown. And this was a moment when, you know, two relatively freshly elected senators sort of went at it, and this was the beginning. I don't know. He's obviously – when Ted Cruz got elected, he was obviously without the support of the party establishment, and he's been pretty much anti-Washington establishment since he got there. This was sort of a minor sort of showdown apparently at a luncheon between two up-and-coming members of the party. She's, repeating that charge. It's interesting to listen to the way she talks about it because, she is – very much supported by the pro-life movement. She's supported by the Susan B. Anthony list. She's spoken at their dinners and fundraisers. And she says, it's time for both sides to end the games on this. And so it's interesting to watch how calibrated this is because she makes it very clear, and she has voted repeatedly to defund Planned Parenthood, but that it's impractical to predicate a shutdown of government because it's not going to happen given that they can't get the votes for cloture to even bring something forward, and that even if they did, President Obama has said he'll veto, and so how are you going to get 67 votes? But she faces Kathleen's right. It's the Democratic strategy against Republicans, and certainly is going to be against her no matter who runs, is not terribly subtle. It's mobilize women. The Democrats have enjoyed a gender gap in the last several elections, and they were crucial in Jean Shaheen beating Scott Brown. And Democrats know that they can mobilize people, and that a lot of the most passionate Democratic support really, is in the context of abortion rights.
Yeah, Kathleen, do you think there's any risk to Senator Ayotte pushing back against conservatives electorally? I mean, can she expect to be hit from the right on this for not going along with the concept of the shutdown?
I think that she could be. I mean, I think there's always going to be a segment of New Hampshire conservatives who are no fan of Kelly Ayotte. I mean, we've seen that before, people talking about primarying her. But I think what she's doing here is, again, making the calculation that she would rather potentially alienate some of the more, the Ted Cruz supporters that might be mm-hmm. here in exchange for, carving herself out as someone who maybe is approaching this in a more practical manner and hoping that she can maybe win over some of the independents. I mean, I think at this this point, it's not realistic that there's going to be a credible mm-hmm. primary challenge to her from the right. So,
oh, you don't think so?
I don't know who it would be. And
I'm interested to hear what you all think. Trent, do you have any ideas?
Don't forget, when she won the primary the first time around, Ovid Lamontagne was arguably much further to the right on this issue than she is, and she beat him. Right.
Not by much. Right. But that was a very different atmosphere. Right.
Different
times, and you know,
2010.
I mean, I don't know who would run against her. Right. I mean, this particularly if Governor Hassan gets in the race, and that's certainly what pretty much everyone is expecting at this point. It's going to be a high stakes race nationally,
absolutely.
And there's going to be a lot of money flowing into this, I just don't see this going to be any.
Yeah, and Josh, let me ask you one more question. I read yesterday that Senator Ayotte is introducing a gender pay equity bill, which is not something Republicans are typically in favor of, kind of mandating that corporations have those kinds of rules about pay equity. I mean, sort of what's the bigger picture? What is she up to in terms of the election?
Well, I think it's sort of a piece with some of her moves on the shutdown. It's wanting to be seen as a sort of pragmatic person on issues that matter to a good slug of the electorate. What's interesting is that she's opposed some of these measures in the past. She said that she was afraid they would retard job creation, and that saying that the federal government should enforce existing laws. This was back in 2013 when some of this stuff was up for vote in 2014. She did introduce with some other GOP senators an amendment which contained some of these provisions which essentially would prohibit retaliation against employees for talking about pay or disclosing their salary history and mandating that men and women must get equal pay for equal work with the proviso that merit pay is still permissible. You can be purely cynical and say, well, this is an election year move. But, she's said she's introduced. All the details aren't out. We haven't spoken with her about it. But it's certainly something that, again, Democrats would be likely to be going after her on.
And let's listen to Kelly Ayotte speaking on the floor of the U.S. Senate on Tuesday.
I'm tired of the people on my side of the aisle who are pushing this strategy even though they know they don't have the votes to have it pass the United States Senate, and they certainly don't have the votes to override a presidential veto. And so, therefore, they can't answer the question, what's the end game for success here?
And that's Kelly Ayotte speaking on the Senate floor Tuesday. And Kathleen, this gets to what you were saying earlier about kind of pushing back on the idea that this would be a useful strategy for Republicans going into an election.
Yeah, I think that, we're seeing this debate within the Republican Party. You have people on the side of Ted Cruz, even someone like Bobby Jindal, obviously, who's not in Congress but has been saying, well, the Republicans in Congress, they need to take a stand. They can't just back off because they don't think they have the votes to do something. So on the one side, you have these conservatives saying, we need to be principled. We need to stand for something. We can't back off of our core beliefs. And on the other side, you have people like Kelly Ayotte, people like Senator Lindsey Graham, who are saying, we need to be practical about the way we lead. We shouldn't just do things to do them. We need to be taking concrete steps. We need to be actually governing here. We need to be showing the electorate that we as Republicans know how to govern if we want to win back the White House. Mm-hmm. So Lindsey Graham in the last debate, made the point that if we play these kind of games, we're not going to win the White House. And winning the White House is ultimately the way that we are able to get these conservative principles through. So we're seeing, a debate within the Republican Party that's kind of mirrors what we've been seeing for, several years now between the more conservative wing of the party and the establishment wing.
Trent, some final thoughts on this issue?
I think that soundbite from Kelly Ayotte on Tuesday was pretty interesting. And she had foresight because when they voted on this yesterday, their first vote on it, one Democrat sided with Republicans on this issue, but eight Republicans sided with Democrats. So I think she's right.
That they view this as a mistake, and strategically speaking.
Yes.
Okay. Another national story with New Hampshire implications is this issue of real ID and the possibility that New Hampshire travelers may soon run into issues with their driver's license, particularly when they try to fly. Josh, what's going on here?
Well, this issue has been percolating for some time. Real ID was passed. I think it went through in 2005 and was set to took effect, maybe 2008. But it was, inspired by September 11th. And it was the idea of creating a driver's license system where there were certain features that were going to be required on every driver's license in every state to enhance security. New Hampshire was, I believe, the first, or, you know, it was one of a handful of states, but I believe the first state to opt out of Real ID. You know, back in 2006, there were people strutting the state house in tricorn hats and, you know, people dressed as Nazis asking for people's papers out of fear that, you know, this would be an invasion of privacy, would create a national database. You know, that bill went through. Governor John Lynch signed it. You know, as rules have gone into effect on Real ID, you know, deadlines have approached and the federal government has said, you know, look, New Hampshire and other states, if, you know, sooner or later people aren't going to be able to get on planes. And so we're reaching the point where the implications of New Hampshire's decision and how the federal government has chosen to implement Real ID are really coming to pass. And, you know, lawmakers want to create some sort of mechanism by which New Hampshire people are going to be able to get on airplanes without great hardship. So they've debated it last year. They tabled it. This one's, you know, there's going to be new legislation drafted that will hope to create a system where people could opt in, basically.
Mm-hmm. Kathleen, what's your sense covering the State House, how this is going to play out?
Well, I mean, we've seen this debate go through a number of times. And last year when it was discussed, some of the issues, as Josh mentioned, have to do with fear that there could be some type of national registry. I mean, to get the Real ID, you need to provide proof of your social security number as well as your birth certificate, I believe. So
yeah, it was a couple of different things. I was surprised to see how many things I would have to produce.
Yeah, so it's much more stringent than just how you would get a normal driver's license right now. And so there's kind of this fear that could this create some type of national registry. I think that, proponents of the law have assured people that it won't be creating that. But I think, we have a Republican lawmaker in the House who's introducing this, and he wants to include opt-out provisions in it. So you have the option to get a Real ID in New Hampshire, but you don't have to if you don't want to. So that will allow people who maybe are concerned about some of the privacy issues around this to opt out of getting that license. But the issue, as Josh said, is eventually it's going to be needed to get on airplanes. It's going to be needed to enter some federal buildings. So I think if you don't have it, I think there are also going to be provisions, you know, that you have to go through some type of advanced security screening, et cetera, to get on planes.
I mean, you could use a passport.
Yeah. Or you could, use a passport.
Shell out is $100 or $110 for a passport. It's funny. I remember when you could fly to Canada using a driver's license, and that's certainly not the case anymore. I want to remind our listeners that this is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. I have three guests today: Kathleen Ronayne, New Hampshire State House reporter for the Associated Press; Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter; and Trent Spinner, executive editor of the Union Leader. And Trent, let me come to you on this issue and just put it in a little bit kind of little sort of larger context of sort of kind of the libertarian ethos in the state.
Well, the first thing I want to say about Real ID is that if you've heard about this, here's the one thing you need to keep in mind, is that you will still be able to fly. No date has been set for this implementation. The deadline, the actual date, has not been set. And federal authorities have said it's probably not going to be until next year. So I think what happened with this story is that a Facebook post started and it spread like wildfire, saying that if you don't get this done now, if you don't get a passport now, New Hampshire residents aren't going to be able to fly. And I took probably dozens of calls in the newsroom from people saying, why haven't you done this story? Why am I learning about this on Facebook? And I've explained to people, well, that post isn't true. You'll still be able to fly at least until next year. No date has been set. And we've reported, I mean, I think every major news outlet in the state has reported the progress of this. And there was really nothing that happened this week on it before that Facebook post, which then drew the attention of legislators who then filed bills. So that's the one thing I think we need to all keep in mind, is that, the sky isn't falling. But, you know, this is an important issue for libertarians in New Hampshire. They don't want to be part of a national registry, and they think that states should have the right to decide how to do their own licenses.
Yeah, it certainly fits in with that transition. We do need to take we do need to take a quick break here, but we'll be right back with more New Hampshire stories. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. The This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We invite you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. I have three guests with me in the studio today. I have Trent Spinner. He's executive editor of the Union Leader. I have Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter, and Kathleen Ronayne, New Hampshire State House reporter for the Associated Press. And folks, let's turn to the 2016 presidential race. We'll talk about Republicans, and then we also have a lot to talk about on the Democrats. Josh, let me start with you. The field narrowed on the Republican side this past week with the campaign suspension by Scott Walker. This kind of caught New Hampshire by surprise, didn't it?
Well, certainly some of the people working for Scott Walker here were caught by surprise, but Scott Walker had been plummeting in the polls for some time. His donors were getting restive. It was unclear whether he was going to get back into it in Iowa, which, you know, he had indicated he really had planned to win. And, you know, he said he was his sort of he I think he used the term when he was called to lead by getting out of the race and, you know, potentially trying to take down Donald Trump. But, you know, Scott Walker entered this race with high hopes. He has an impressive political record, a conservative one in the state of Wisconsin. He gave a big speech in Iowa earlier this year where he was vaulted to the top of the GOP polls, and that's a dangerous place to find yourself. And, you know, he was perceived by a lot of people as a candidate who could potentially, as they say, touch all the bases within the party and, you know, attract establishment support, attract, you know, core conservative support. You know, didn't really add up. He wasn't a great candidate on the stump. He had a number of stumbles on his positions. And, you know, he's out and we're one down. And it's unclear where his support would go. I mean, in the polls, he was so low at this point that it's hard to really, get too agitated about, like, where the Walker vote goes.
Kathleen, you cover the presidential race as well. Your sense of whether this has any impact at all on the dynamics of the race here in New Hampshire or in general?
I mean, I think on the one hand, it obviously shows the dangers of peaking too early. That's what happened with Scott Walker. I think he formally entered the race in June, I think.
Yeah, and
he entered,
like 70 days,
you know, like Josh there. Said, I mean, he was at the top of the field, and it puts a lot of expectations on you. It makes you a target for other people. And it makes, you know, your donors expect a lot. Mm-hmm. They want you to, you know, to be able to stay there. And so I think for a lot of candidates, someone like Marco Rubio, who's been flying under the radar a bit. I mean, he has been spending a ton of time in Iowa and New Hampshire. Instead, he's been, you know, raising a lot of money. And I think that people who may have been questioning why he hasn't been here so much, I'm hearing them now say, well, that actually sounds like it's a great strategy. You know, he's making sure that he has the money to go the distance, mm-hmm. and he's making sure that he doesn't peak too early. Mm-hmm. With so many candidates in this field, you know, we've seen Donald Trump is always willing to kind of attack whoever the flavor of the week is in the Republican field. And so far, Donald Trump is still polling at the top, even though that seems to be falling a little bit. So you don't necessarily want to be the person in his crosshairs. As far as the field in general, Walker called on people to drop out. At this point, we haven't really seen anyone who is ready to make that move to drop out. So I don't really think we're going to see the dynamics of this race start to shift hugely until a few more people begin dropping out and we get a chance to see who they are. I mean, are establishment people falling off? Are the more religious conservatives falling off? Who are the next people to get out of this race? But right now, there's still, I think, 14 candidates, 15 if you count Jim Gilmore, but he hasn't been on the debate stage at all. So 14 candidates left in the race. And like Josh said, you know, it's not like there's this massive amount of Walker support that's right. going to one candidate. You know, I think in New Hampshire, we're going to see the people that backed him probably kind of spread out among, you know, Rubio, Christie, Kasich, the people that have been in New Hampshire. Jeb Bush, Carly Fiorina, the people who have been here quite a bit.
I think his co-chair went to Rubio, if I remember correctly.
And that
correctly.
Was actually in the works before Walker even dropped out. He was already
thinking.
So the
writing was already on the wall.
Yeah, I talked to him on the phone and he said, you know, I'm smart enough to know that when you're at 1% in the polls, no one's going to give you any money or something to that effect.
And to identify the co-chair.
Oh, Cliff Hurst. He had been with Walker but is now on board with Rubio.
Mm-hmm. Trent, could you say that Walker was done in by his own expectations, that this was an expectations game starting off?
I absolutely think that's what happened to him. I think that the polls at the very beginning were wrong that had him in the lead. I think that so many at that point, I'm sure we're going to talk about this later, but so many people were undecided that it wasn't really fair to say that he was the front runner or even at the head of the pack. I think that when people actually met him in New Hampshire and he sat in their living room or they went to his town halls, I think they were underwhelmed. I don't think that he had a coherent stump speech. I don't think he made strong points that really resonated with people here. And I don't think that he did well with regular voters here. And I think that translated into when he decided to drop out of the race. He didn't call anyone in New Hampshire to let them know. As reporters, sometimes we're put into uncomfortable positions. And one of the most uncomfortable things is calling somebody and telling them to say, hey, you may not have heard this yet, but you are going to lose your job today during his 6 p.m. press conference. And we were making those phone calls where campaign staffers and supporters had no idea. They were not in the know. And I think that's really telling about where the Walker campaign placed New Hampshire in their list of priorities.
Mm-hmm. And Josh, we do have this new WMUR poll that was out yesterday. Has Trump at 26, Fiorina at 16, and then Rubio, Carson, Kasich, Bush on down the line. What do you see happening in the state right now? Just kind of your general sense of is anything really changing or is it still just all about Donald Trump?
Well, I'm not sure anything's changing. I just think we're holding steady. I agree with Kathleen is that until the field thins a little bit, it's hard to know. And, you know, I've given up looking past the horizon of, Donald Trump's sinking because, right. It hasn't happened thus far. And so we'll see how it goes. I mean, I think as it becomes fall, voters who are going to participate in the Republican primary will, get more serious about figuring out who they're going to support. I mean, that poll indicates that very, very few people have made up their mind. And so right. and I do think it's worth noting the challenge of even polling when the field is so large. I mean, how do you even ask – if you have to ask about all these people, how do you even ask the number of questions you need to know – whether someone is actually going to be voting in the primary. And so the logistics of a big field are large, and as it narrows, I think we'll have a much better sense of what sort of nominee or at least what sort of person is going to win the New Hampshire primary.
Mm-hmm. Now, John Kasich is someone who his PAC had invested a lot of money up front with advertising. He was doing quite well in the polls. In this current MUR poll, he's tied with Jeb Bush. I'm sure I'm not the first person to make that slip up. Jeb Bush. Yes, exactly. He's tied with Jeb Bush at 7%. During a visit to New Hampshire this week, Lindsey Graham was asked by NH1 anchor Paul Steinhauser to respond to a comment that this is a comment John Kasich made about the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard and that base closures are generally a good motivator in terms of getting employees to work. Let's take a listen.
I don't think John Kasich gets where the world is at, that the dangers to this country do not justify gutting the military. And when you suggest that we need to close bases, you really don't understand how our footprint actually is. We need to increase our military footprint around the world.
And that is Lindsey Graham, senator from South Carolina, talking to NH1 anchor Paul Steinhauser recently about the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. And Kathleen Ronayne, is this anything that John Kasich sort of tried to walk it back a little bit? Is this generally how is he doing in the state? Has this hurt him? Why do you think he's sort of down at 7%?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll just say, I mean, if you've listened to John Kasich at all, it shouldn't come as a surprise that he's suggesting that maybe we need to evaluate whether we should close some bases. Part of his, stump that he does is he talks about how he's all for having a strong military, but he wants to make sure we're having an efficient military, that we're spending our money in the right way. So I don't think it's wholly surprising that he would come out and say, when base closures have been something that have been talked about for, years now, for him to say maybe this is something we should consider. I think it's the way he said it as well that is causing a little bit of trouble. And we have to keep in mind that, Senator Ayotte, I think, hit him a little bit for saying that. And her and Senator Shaheen, I know as of last year, they had like the ranking positions on the subcommittee that deals with base closures. So they are very strongly in favor of keeping the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard open. So it's definitely something that, I think people are going to – it's going to bother people probably about John Kasich. I don't know if it's something that's enough to sink John Kasich. And I think that, you know, he's another person who came on pretty strongly in New Hampshire, got a lot of support, a lot of initial interest. He's rolled out some really significant endorsements. So we just have to watch if he's going to be able to sustain that.
And Trent, is this a case of John Kasich or his campaign sort of not really understanding how important that shipyard is for the state and how hard Senators Ayotte and Shaheen sort of push any time that's even mentioned as a possibility for closing?
I don't think this is going to be a big issue in the race. I'm not sure he was going to win the shipyard vote in the first place. I don't know how many Republicans would win that vote anyway. So I don't think this is going to be a big issue.
Yeah, Josh?
I think that perhaps Kasich's remarks were sort of over-construed by some as a hit directly on the shipyard, and maybe he should have been sensitive enough to recognize that and say things differently. And for Graham, you know, and that's a sort of a twofer. I mean, he can sort of go after, like, I stand with the shipyard, and obviously he stands generically for a larger and more robust military presence. So, you know, it's a good thing for him to whack Kasich on.
And Graham has certainly been here a lot, and he's been one of the more hawkish Republicans on the campaign trail.
And whacking everybody.
Hitting everyone hard, that's correct. Let me tell our listeners, this is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. I have three guests with me today. Kathleen Ronay, New Hampshire State House reporter for the Associated Press, Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, and Trent Spinner, executive editor of the Union Leader. And folks, let's shift gears now and talk about the Democrats. We had this big state Democratic Party convention recently in Manchester. And Kathleen, let me turn first to you for just kind of a general overview for our listeners of what that was all about.
Yeah, so it's the state party's annual convention. It was held at the Verizon Center, which I think they got about 4,000 people to attend, which is pretty good size. I think some people, when they said it was going to be at the Verizon Center, were initially like, oh, are you going to get enough people to show up for that on a Saturday? But they had some good attractions. They had Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Martin O'Malley, as well as, you know, the state's congressional delegation, the governor. So pretty much all the who's who of Democratic politics. We also heard speeches from some up and coming Democrats who all seem to be chomping at the bit to run for governor if Maggie Hassan runs for Senate. So we heard from Colin Van Oster and Stephanie Shaheen, Mark Connolly, some people who have thrown their names out there. So it's basically just a gathering and an effort to energize the base, to get people excited about the presidential candidates. I think for me, one of the most interesting things that happened is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chairwoman of the DNC, was there and kicked off the morning. And there's been a little bit of a controversy within the DNC over the number of presidential debates they're doing. They're only doing six, and I think four before the caucuses and primaries begin. So supporters of Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, some others have been demanding more debates from the DNC. I think some of the debates are going to be held on Saturdays. They feel that this is a very unfair schedule that it essentially is made to continue the Hillary Clinton coronation. So it was pretty remarkable when Wasserman Schultz was giving her speech. She started getting drowned out by these chants from the crowd of, we want debates, we want debates. And at first it was kind of quiet. She was able to speak over it. But then it kept growing and growing to the point where she actually had to stop her speech and punch back, and it got pretty tense. Yep.
And we actually can listen to that right now. We can hear, this is Deborah Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the DNC, talking at the convention.
President Obama, a Muslim. My friends, what's more important, drawing a contrast with Republicans or arguing about debates? Let's focus on our mission and the task at hand. Enough is enough.
And that's Debbie Wasserman Schultz talking at the State Democratic Convention in Manchester. And Trent and then Josh, what do you think about this whole issue of the debates? Is it being overblown? Is this a conspiracy, or what's your thoughts?
I think this is a huge deal, and I think this is going to blow up in the DNC's face. The DNC sanctioned debates this cycle, and the only debate they're doing in New Hampshire is with us, the Union Leader, WMUR, and ABC News. That's on December 19th. That is 1 week before Christmas. And I don't know about you, but 1 week on the Saturday night before Christmas, I'm busy. And I think a lot of voters are too. And they're upset, number one, that they had to wait so long for the first debate. they had to wait so long for the first debate in New Hampshire, and that there won't be any other debates in New Hampshire closer to the primary. So I think you'll see something develop here. The DNC says that they're going to punish candidates who participate in unsanctioned debates. People say, wait, I thought we still live in a democracy. Mm-hmm. And so I think you'll see something develop here in New Hampshire.
Well, it's interesting. You know, parties often threaten to penalize. And then what happens is the nominee, once they're comfortable that they're a nominee, sort of gives them a dispensation and everybody is happy in the end. You know, Josh, I've always thought, you know, having 20 debates, 24 debates or whatever is too much. But six debates, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, we'll see. I was at the convention, and it was loud, and some of it was drowned out. It was interesting that Clinton campaign had given out these thunder sticks, which are these, you know, sort of turgid balloon-like things
right,
that bang together and make
together,
a lot of noise.
Right.
And they were – and so some of the We Want Debates was drowned out by the banging of the Clinton thunder sticks. But people are definitely angry about this, and I guess I wouldn't be surprised if maybe more debates ended up happening. But, you know, and even Jean Shaheen, when she got up there, at one point she made a pro-Clinton comment, and, you know, the crowd got sort of angry, and she stopped the crowd and said, you know, I'm backing Hillary, but I also like, you know, Bernie and Martin O'Malley. You know, it is interesting. I was after this Wasserman Schultz thing happened, though, I was listening. I was thinking, like, well, it's going to be interesting when Hillary Clinton gets up there. Are people going to go at her with the "we want more debates"? And there was none of that. And so, you know, we'll see where this goes. But I don't think it's hard to interpret the DNC's original debate plan was something that would essentially, you know, grease the skids for the prohibitive favorite, Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kathleen?
Yeah, and I think it's – I mean, it is about the number of debates, but it's also about when the debates are. I mean, like Trent said, having a debate on a Saturday right before Christmas, who's going to watch that? Nobody is going to tune in to watch that debate. And so I think it might not be such an issue if there were six debates, but the debates were on Tuesday evenings or sometime when people would be much more likely to tune in. People wouldn't be busy. So we've heard, you know, Martin O'Malley griping about this quite a bit. Sanders to a lesser extent. But I think that, you know, I don't think when people in your own party during a primary process are, you know, chanting that they want more debates, I don't really think the way that you stop that and clamp down on that is by saying enough is enough and essentially saying I'm not going to listen to you. The plan is the plan. This is what we're doing. And you're being foolish for focusing on this. I don't know that that is really the way for the DNC to handle the issue. And so we'll see what happens going forward. But yeah, I mean, as Josh said, you know, a lot of this, the anger from the people within the auditorium or the stadium, it was really directed at the DNC, not at Clinton herself, even though there is a feeling that this is part of the coronation effort.
Yeah. Trent, quick comment.
And let's think back to 2008. That was the cycle where you had Biden, Edwards, Hillary Clinton, Obama. There were 26 debates in 2008. In the 2008 cycle, and so now we're talking about six. People are unhappy,
and so do you think? Anything? You think there's going to be any chance that they'll back down on this?
I think what's going to happen is Bernie Sanders is going to have to come up and say we need to have another debate, and the Sanders campaign has not come out directly and said we're going to take part in an unsanctioned debate. I think if they do, the Clinton campaign and O'Malley campaigns, they don't have an option.
And Sanders has been saying he'd be ready to debate Republicans as well. Well, we need to take one more break. But coming up, we'll continue talking politics and get to some of the other states' top news stories. So stay with us. It's The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can call in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, and find us on Facebook and Twitter. And I have three guests with me in the studio today for the Roundup: Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, Trent Spinner, executive editor of the Union Leader, and Kathleen Ronayne, New Hampshire State House reporter for the Associated Press. And folks, we've been talking about the Democratic State Convention. We mentioned Hillary Clinton. Here's a little sound from Hillary speaking at the convention about her husband, former President Bill Clinton.
After 8 years of hard work, a lot of political heavy lifting,
the end of Bill's second term, there was a really important set of statistics that represented the progress we made. 23 million new jobs, a balanced budget. But you know what was most important to me? For the first time in decades, everybody benefited, not just those at the top, but people in the middle, people at the bottom. Everybody saw their incomes go up.
And that's Hillary Clinton speaking last weekend at the state Democratic Party convention. We're going to continue to follow the presidential race on the Democratic side. But Josh Rogers, there was also some other interesting activity and speculation at the Democratic convention involving the governor's race in particular. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Governor Hassan had said she was going to make her plans on 2016 clear when the budget was resolved. The budget is now resolved. She signaled prior to the convention that she wasn't likely to explicitly address her future at the convention. And while everybody was listening very hard, there wasn't much you could pick at in terms of getting a sense of what she's doing. But it does seem increasingly likely that she is, in fact, going to run for Senate. And there were certainly other candidates on stage who are going to be running for governor if she does make that decision. You have Colin Van Ostern, who's probably the most clear about his intentions of the possible candidates.
Executive counselor.
He spoke and then provided to his list of supporters in the press kind of an annotated copy of his remarks afterwards. Stephanie Shaheen, who is eyeing the race as well, that came as a little bit of a surprise. Apparently, Emily's List got in touch with her, the political action committee that's dedicated to electing pro-choice female candidates, got in touch with her and asked her to look at it. And she has said she would, certainly if she were to get it. She's a Portsmouth city councilor. She had signaled she wasn't going to run again. If that happens, that would create a dynamic that people hadn't foreseen. Chris Pappas, executive councilor, he also spoke. He was seen as somebody who might run in the first district with Carol Shea Porter, making it official that she's going to be running for her old seat. It makes his candidacy in that race less likely. So he's in the mix. Mark Connolly, who is the director of New Hampshire Securities Division under the Secretary of State's Office of Regulator, he's looking at the race. And there's some state senators. A lot of them always look in the mirror and see someone who's governor. Some of them are looking at the race. And so, you know, the dominoes are starting to fall.
I was just going to use that phrase. Trent, there's a potential for a domino effect here.
Yes. I mean, I think after watching on Saturday – look, I was one of the people who spent the whole summer thinking that the governor was going to run for governor again. I thought that she was not interested in Senate, certainly wasn't making any moves on the Senate race. But I think after watching sort of all the party insiders and how they interacted on Saturday, I think it's very clear that she's going to run for Senate and open up the governor's seat for someone else.
Yeah, Kathleen.
Yeah, I will, just a few other things. I mean, I think it's interesting that of all the speakers they had, you know, we have a lot of people who have made it clear that they want to run for governor, yet there's nobody up there who has made it clear that they might consider a race for U.S. Senate should the governor not choose to go there. So I think that just further demonstrates kind of the immense pressure that she is under to run for Senate, because Democrats really know it's going to be very hard for them to find a credible competitor to Kelly Ayotte if the governor takes a pass. So I would guess we're going to hear something within the next few weeks. The governor herself, after the budget deal was done, we asked her, okay, when are we? You don't have the budget excuse anymore, so when are we going to hear about this? And she gave some kind of, you know, sooner rather than later, so no timeline. But I also did notice that they did this video montage before she spoke, and she has a new slogan, which is Maggie Hassan, always New Hampshire. And I don't think that she had a slogan when she was running for governor last time. I might be wrong.
So the idea is, in case you think she's becoming too Washington, she's always
Always, I mean, I don't know. The slogan seemed a little like for a U.S. Senate campaign to me. I mean, obviously, we're all just reading the tea leaves here, but I noticed, you know, that's never been a slogan of hers before. So
yeah, well, open seats don't come along all that often for a statewide office. I want to turn – we've done a lot of politics here, so I want to turn our attention to a couple of other stories, and then we can always circle back if we have time. A couple other stories involving New Hampshire cities and towns. And Kathleen, let me turn to you first on this story that we're hearing from the small town of Croydon up in the Dartmouth-Sunapee region. is getting a lot of attention for being caught in the middle of a tuition dispute between its schools and the state. What's going on here?
Yeah, so school funding, as we know, is always complicated in New Hampshire. Issues of school choice. The Croydon School District, which just has, I think, 37 students between 5th and 12th grade, so a very small town we're talking about here, last year made the decision to withdraw from the Newport SAU, and they've given their students the option that they can go, if they don't want to go to the Newport schools anymore, they could go to other public or private schools. So five students have chosen to go to private schools with tuition upwards of $8,000. And what the town has done is they're essentially taking their taxpayer money for schools, and rather than giving it to the SAU like they would normally do, they're saying, we'll pay if you want to go somewhere else, we'll use the taxpayer dollars and we'll pay for you to go to a private school. So it's launched this battle with the AG's office, who is saying you can't do that. The tax dollars that you bring in for schools need to go to your designated SAU, whereas they're saying, well, we pulled out of that SAU. These are our town's tax dollars. We'd like to be able to use them how we choose to educate our students. So, you know, very small town, but I think it does, you know, hit on issues of school choice and education funding and how tax dollars should be used, what power parents and schools should have to be able to send their children to places other than the designated school. You know, in a broader context, we're going to see the school choice or the school funding battle come up again next year. The city of Dover has sued the state over what they say is an unfair school funding formula. This has been a problem for New Hampshire for pretty much two decades now, over how we adequately fund education, how we properly use the property tax dollars that pay for a lot of education. So definitely an interesting story. And, you know, small town in a battle with the AG's office. So we'll see what happens.
And it sounds like they're sticking with it, though. I
mean, they're saying we're not going to comply with what the AG's office wants. So we'll see where it goes from there.
Well, it is a very small town. I think they only have like a K through four or something like that. It's a very small school. Turn our attention to actually, I'm going to go to you, Trent, with a story that we've been following for, and your paper's been following for a while now. The body cam footage from a police officer involved shooting is going to be released this afternoon, I believe. Tell us what's going on in that story.
So a man was killed by police in the North Country. It was on a public road, and there was police body camera video. These are those new video cameras that you've seen in stories all across the country. But police officers actually captured this man's death on video. They say that he was rushing towards them with a knife, and they had no other option but to fire on him. He was killed. And while the report was being released, while the investigation was happening, the family said that they want to release this video. They want to see it to make sure that the police officers acted the way they should. When the video finally came out, the wife of the man who was killed said, "You know, it would be too harmful for our children to see this. So we don't want the video released." And they filed an emergency injunction against the video being released. We had filed a right to know request for the video, along with some other news organizations. And a judge has ruled there were hearings, and you know, WMUR was involved, the Concord Monitor, Valley News, Union Leader, all these media organizations pushing for the video to be released. And the judge took it under advisement and then ruled that the video could be released up to the point of the shooting. This is the only disputed video release in the country involving a fatal police shooting. Everywhere else in the country, we see that there's a fatal police shooting. If there's body camera video of it, it gets released. And so this case is going to set some precedent, which is why we're fighting to make sure that it is released. We think as the press, we have this responsibility to make sure that the government, and especially the government where they take this ultimate – this is the ultimate decision a government official can make, taking somebody's life. And we think it's our job, in the press and as members of the public, to make sure that these government officials are doing the right thing. And that's why we're fighting to get this video released.
Yes. So this is something that may have implications all around the country. Let's go to the phones now. And we have Chris calling us from Hampton. Chris, welcome to The Exchange.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Well, I was calling. I heard your panelists talking about polling.
Right.
And I just wanted to give – I was called this Saturday. I took a call from a Colorado number, because it had kept calling me. And when I got on with the phone, I engaged in a poll that took around 45 minutes. When I asked the woman how much longer, she said a few more minutes. I said, has anyone finished this? She told me I was the first person that day who might actually finish her poll. So I was just wondering, with that in mind, how reliable are these polls that we're hearing about?
And thanks, Chris. Thanks for that question. Trent.
Chris, I think you bring up a fantastic point that you should not believe polls that you see right now. They are not accurate. And that's not just the poll that you talked about. I mean, that is a very extreme example. But even shorter polls, I think. Let's take a look at the UNH poll that came out this week. They polled a little bit over slightly over 800 people. I think it was 820 people. That's a very big sample size, and they do a very good job polling there. But 75% on the Democratic side, 75% of people said that they haven't made up their mind yet. So that leaves you with 200 people. 200 people trying – you're trying to define where the race stands in a state of 1.3 million people based on 200 people. And it gets even worse on the Republican side. That – there, the UNH poll found that only 13% of Republicans said that they were decided on who they were going to vote for. So you're talking about 100 people trying – you're trying to determine where the race stands based on 100 – in a state of 1.3 million people based on responses from about 100 people. That means that if half a dozen people switch from Trump to Fiorina, from Graham to somewhere else, that could completely skew the number. So – Chris, I think you bring up a great point that you should be very careful and hesitant about looking at those polls right now.
And there is so much polling going on now. Everybody's polling. There's sample issues, robocalls, et cetera, et cetera. Kathleen, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's a little bit of merit, though, in some of the polls coming out right now, even if people haven't made up their minds, to see how the favorability on various candidates is shifting. You know, I might not know that I want to who I want to vote for, but I might know that, you know, I don't view Donald Trump very favorably. And I think that there is some merit to polls that we're seeing now to look how people feel about these candidates and to see, you know, maybe in July, Carly Fiorina, no one really knew who she was and everybody was choosing Donald Trump. Whereas in September, you might see that suddenly a lot more people know who Carly Fiorina is and have a positive view of her. Obviously, you know, it is early and there are issues with any type of poll, but I don't think we can totally discount, you know, maybe we shouldn't be looking necessarily at who's winning based on these polls. But I think if you look at the trend of the polls over time, it can say a lot about how the electorate is feeling about the candidates.
Right. And a lot of websites have averages of polls that you can look at. They average a larger number of polls. Josh, I want to turn to you. Just one quick story. It's going back on politics. Carol Shea Porter has announced that she's officially in the race to win back her seat from Frank Ginta. What's the latest there?
Well, it's not surprising that she, you know, she feels in the wake of, particularly in the wake of Frank Ginta's fundraising issues stretching, you know, well back. But the revelation that the FEC, you know, found that his explanations for money that, you know, ended up in his campaign back in 2010 did in fact come from his parents. You know, she feels essentially she probably would have won last fall had that been come out beforehand. And so, you know, she's going to give it a go. It's potentially sets the stage for, you know, the fourth time that those two would have faced each other, assuming Ginta gets through the primary. But certainly if Carol Shea Porter runs, you know, that means a lot of other Democrats who might be looking at that seat aren't going to go. And, you know, that's going to be an interesting on the Republican side. You know, Dan Innes is out there and he's, you know, did pretty well last time and he's looking at it again. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But certainly Shea Porter back in the mix, a very known quantity.
Mm-hmm. And Trent, the union leader has had a contentious relationship with Frank Ginta. Your thoughts on this race?
I think it's going to be an absolute blowout showdown battle. I mean, this four-peat right now would be unbelievable to watch, and I think there will be lots of coverage on it.
Mm-hmm. Kathleen?
I just think, I mean, everyone's kind of been joking about this, but, you know, you have to imagine that it might be a little bit hard for voters in the first district to get excited about a Ginta-Shea Porter rematch and also the possibility of like a Clinton Bush, a Shaheen Sununu. Like, think about what that ticket in the first district could look like. And I just don't know that you're driving like a lot of enthusiasm among voters.
A lot of familiar names for sure. Well, we're going to be watching it. I think it's going to be really interesting. Well, we're almost out of time, and I want to give you all an opportunity to tell us what you're going to be working on next week. And Josh, let me start with you.
Well, you know, next week, there haven't been so many candidates here this week. You know, we'll see who shows up next week. I mean, I'm sort of curious. I've been spending a lot of time on the Republicans, and I'm going to be focusing more on the Democrats and, you know, sort of trying to kick the tires a little bit on you know, Bernie Sanders draws big crowds and, you know, passionate supporters. You know, how do you translate that into a campaign that can deliver? We know that Hillary Clinton's got a very you know, powerful campaign apparatus, and I'm going to be taking a look at the Democrats.
Always a big challenge to translate excitement into votes. Trent, what are you looking at?
I think that the Croydon school choice fight, it has the potential to blow up into a national story. The selectmen this week voted to send a letter to the attorney general's office saying, hey, AG's office, we're not listening to you. We're going to do what we think is right for the town, and that means sending kids to a private Montessori school. I think the next step is that the attorney general's office probably has to file an injunction. And that means a court fight. I'm not sure where Croydon stands in terms of its legal footing, which means they need public support and new laws to allow them to continue doing that. And I think that would make this into a big deal.
Kathleen.
Like everyone else in New Hampshire, I'll be waiting to see if Governor Hassan makes a decision and how the dominoes fall after that.
Mm-hmm. All politics, all the time. Well, we are out of time here, and I'd like to thank my guests for joining us this morning. Josh, always good to talk to you.
Thanks, Dean.
Josh Rogers, senior political reporter from NHPR. Trent, good to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Trent Spinner, executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Kathleen, it's always great to talk to you.
Thanks, Dean.
That's Kathleen Ronayne, State House reporter for the Associated Press. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.